old, and not yet big for his age as he would be from the time he was 9 or 10. Even if he could teleport into Salfont's bedroom, the advantage of surprise might not be sufficient to ensure success. If either Salfont or his wife happened to be awake when Candy arrived, or if the first slash of the knife failed to kill the lawyer and brought him awake in a defensive panic, Candy would not be able to overpower him. He wouldn't be in danger of getting caught or harmed, for he could teleport home in a wink, but he would risk being recognized. Police would believe a man like Salfont, even as regarded such a fantastic accusation as murder lodged against a 5-year-old boy. They would visit the Pollard place, asking questions, poking around, and God knew what they might find or come to suspect.
"So you can't kill him, though he deserves it," Roselle whispered as she rocked her favorite child. She stared down intently into his eyes as he looked up from her exposed breast. "Instead, what you have to do is take something from him as vengeance for the money he took from me. Something precious to him. There's a new baby in the Salfont house. I read about it in the paper a few months ago. A little girl baby they called Rebecca Elizabeth. What kind of name is that for a girl, I ask you? Sounds highfalutin to me. The kind of name a fancy lawyer and his wife give a baby because they think them and theirs is better than other people. Elizabeth is a queen's name, you see, and you just look up what Rebecca is in the Bible, see if they don't think way too much of themselves and their little brat. Rebecca. She's almost 6 months old now. They've had her long enough to miss her when she's gone. Miss her bad. I'll drive you past their house tomorrow, my precious little candy boy. Let you see where it is. And tomorrow night, you'll go there and visit the Lord's vengeance on them. My vengeance. They'll say a rat got into the room or something of the sort, and they'll blame themselves until the day they're dead, too."
The throat of Rebecca Salfont had been tender, her blood salty. Candy enjoyed the adventure of it, the thrill of entering the house of strangers without their permission or knowledge. Killing the girl while grown-up slept in the adjoining room unaware filled him with a sense of power. He was just a boy, yet he slipped past their defenses and struck a blow for his mother, which, in a way, made him the man of the Pollard house. That heady feeling added an element of glory to the excitement of the kill. His mother's requests for vengeance were thereafter irresistible. For the first few years of his mission, infants and very young children were his only prey. Sometimes, in order not to present a pattern to the police, he did not bite them, but disposed of them in other ways. And occasionally he took hold of them and teleported out of the house with them, so no body was ever found. Even so, if Roselle's enemies had all been from in and around Santa Barbara, the pattern could not have been hidden. But often she required vengeance against people in far places about whom she read in newspapers and magazines. He remembered in particular a family in New York State who won millions of dollars in the lottery. His mother had felt that their good fortune had been at the expense of the Pollard family, and that they were too greedy to be permitted to live. Candy had been 14 at the time, and he had not understood his mother's reasoning, but he had not questioned it either. She was the only source of truth to him, and the thought of disobedience never crossed his mind. He had killed all 5 members of that family in New York, then burned their house to the ground with their bodies in it. His mother's thirst for vengeance followed a predictable cycle. Immediately after Candy killed someone for her, she was happy, filled with plans for the future. She would bake special treats for him and sing melodically while she worked in the kitchen, and she would begin a new quilt or an elaborate needlepoint project. But over the next 4 weeks, her happiness would dim like a light bulb on a rheostat, and almost 1 month to the day after the killing, having lost interest in baking and crafts, she would begin to talk about other people who had wronged her and, by extension, the Pollard family. Within 2 to 4 more weeks, she would have settled on a target, and Candy would be dispatched to fulfill his mission. Consequently, he killed on only 6 or 7 occasions each year. That frequency satisfied Roselle, but the older Candy got, the less it satisfied him. He had not merely acquired a thirst for blood, but a craving that occasionally overwhelmed him. The thrill of the hunt also intoxicated him, and he longed for it as an alcoholic longed for the bottle. Not least of all, the mindless hostility of the world toward his blessed mother motivated him to kill more often. Sometimes it seemed that virtually everyone was against her, scheming to harm her physically or to take money that was rightfully hers. She had no dearth of enemies. He remembered days when fear oppressed her. Then, at her direction, all the blinds and drapes were drawn, the doors locked, and sometimes even barricaded with chairs and other furniture against the onslaught of adversaries who never came, but who might have. On those bad days, she became despondent and told him that so many people were out to get her that even he could not protect her forever. When he begged her to turn him loose, she refused and only said, "It's hopeless." Then, as now, he tried to supplement the approved murders with his forays into the canyons in search of small animals. But those blood feasts, rich as they sometimes were, never quenched his thirst as thoroughly as when the vessel was human. Saddened by too many memories, Candy rose from the rocking chair and nervously paced the room. The blind was up, and he glanced with increasing interest at the night beyond the window. After failing to catch Frank and the stranger who had teleported into the backyard with him, after the confrontation with Violet had taken that unexpected turn and left him with undissipated rage, he was smoldering, hot to kill, but in need of a target. With no enemy of the family in sight, he would have to slaughter either innocent people or the small creatures that lived in the canyons. The problem was, he dreaded evoking his sainted mother's disappointment up there in heaven, yet he had no appetite for the thin blood of timid beasts. His frustration and need built by the minute. He knew he was going to do something he would later regret, something that would make Roselle turn her face from him for a time. Then, just when he felt he might explode, he was saved by the intrusion of a genuine enemy. A hand touched the back of his head. He whirled around, feeling the hand withdraw as he turned. It had been a phantom hand. No one was there. But he knew it was the same presence that he had sensed in the canyon last night. Someone out there, not of the Pollard family, had psychic ability of his own. And the very fact that Roselle was not his mother made him an enemy to be found and eliminated. The same person had visited Candy several times earlier in the afternoon, reaching out tentatively, probing at him but not making full contact. Candy returned to the rocking chair. If a real enemy was going to put in an appearance, it would be worth waiting for him. A few minutes later, he felt the touch again, light, hesitant, quickly withdrawn. He smiled. He started rocking. He even hummed softly one of his mother's favorite songs. Banking the coals of rage eventually made them burn brighter. By the time the shy visitor grew bolder, the fire would be white hot, and the flames would consume him.
At 7:10, the doorbell rang. Felina Karagiosis did not hear it, of course, but each room of the house had a small red signal lamp in one corner or another, and she could not miss the flashing light that was activated by the bell. She went into the foyer and looked through the side light next to the front door. When she saw Alice Casper, a neighbor from three doors down the street, she switched off the dead bolt, removed the security chain from the slot, and let her in. "Hi, kid. How you doing?" "I like your hair," Felina signed. "Do you really?" "Just got it cut." And the girl said, "Did I want the same old, or did I want to catch up with the times?" And I thought, what the hell? I'm not too old to be sexy, do you think? Alice was only 33, 5 years older than Felina. She had exchanged her trademark blonde curls for a more modern cut that would require a new source of income just to pay for all the mousse she was going to use. But she looked great. "Come in. Want a drink?" "Oh, I'd love a drink, kid. And right now I could use 6 of them. But I gotta say no. My in-laws came over. And we're about to either play cards with them or shoot them. It depends on their attitude." Of all the people Felina knew in her day-to-day life, Alice was the only one other than Clint who understood sign language. Given the fact that most people harbored a prejudice against the deaf, to which they could not admit, but on which they acted, Alice was her only girlfriend. But Felina happily would have given up their friendship if Mark Casper, Alice's son, for whom she had learned sign language, had not been born deaf. why I came over. We got a call from Clint, asking me to tell you he's not on his way home yet, but he expects to get here maybe by 8. Since when does he work so late? They've got a big case. That always means some overtime. He's going to take you out to dinner. Says to tell you it's been an incredible day. I guess that's about the case, huh? Must be fascinating. Married to a detective. And he's so sweet, too. Oh, you're a lucky kid. Yes, but so is he. Alice laughed. Right on. And if he comes home this late another night, don't settle for dinner. Make him buy you diamonds. Felina thought of the red gem that he had brought home yesterday and wished she could tell Alice about it, but Dakota and Dakota business, especially concerning an ongoing case in which the client was in jeopardy, was as sacred in their house as the privacies of the marriage bed. Saturday, our place, 6:30. Jack'll cook up a mess of his chili, and we'll play pinochle and eat chili and drink beer and fart till we pass out. Okay? Yes. And tell Clint it's okay. We won't expect him to talk. Felina laughed, then signed, "He's getting better." Well, that's because you're civilizing him, kid. They hugged again, and Alice left. Felina closed the door, looked at her wristwatch, and saw that it was 7 o'clock. She had only an hour to get ready for dinner, and she wanted to look especially good for Clint. Not because this was a special occasion, but because she always wanted to look good for him. She headed for the bedroom, then realized that only the automatic lock was engaged on the front door. She returned to the foyer, twisted the thumb screw that slid the deadbolt home, and slipped the security chain in place. Clint worried about her too much. If he came home and found that she hadn't remembered the deadbolt, he'd age a year in a minute. Right before her eyes. After being off duty all day, Hal Yamataka responded to a call from Clint and came to the offices at 6:35 Tuesday night to stand watch in case Frank returned after the rest of them had left. Clint met him in the reception lounge and briefed him there over a cup of coffee. He had to be brought up to date on what had happened during his absence, and after he heard what had gone down, he again wistfully considered a career in gardening. Nearly everyone in his family either had a gardening business or owned a little nursery, and all of them did well, most of them better than what Hal made working for Dakota and Dakota, some of them a great deal better. His folks, his three brothers, and various well-meaning uncles tried repeatedly to persuade him that he should work for them or come into business with them, but he resisted. It was not that he had anything against running a nursery, selling gardening supplies, landscape planning, tree pruning, or even gardening itself. But in Southern California, the term Japanese gardener was a cliché, not a career, and he couldn't abide the thought of being any kind of stereotype. He had been a heavy reader of adventure and suspense novels all his life, and he yearned to be a character like one of those he read about, especially a character worthy of being a lead in a John D. MacDonald novel, because John D.'s lead characters were as rich in insight as they were in courage, every bit as sensitive as they were tough. In his heart, Hal knew that his work at Dakota and Dakota was usually as mundane as the daily grind of a gardener, and that the opportunities for heroism in the security industry were far fewer than they appeared to be to outsiders. But selling a bag of mulch, or a can of spectracide, or a flat of marigolds, you couldn't kid yourself that you were a romantic figure or had any chance of being one. And after all, self-image was often the better part of reality. "If Frank shows up here," Hal said, "what do I do with him?" "Pack him in the car and take him to Bobby and Julie." "You mean their house?" "No, Santa Barbara. They're driving up there tonight, staying at the Red Lion Inn, so tomorrow they can start digging into the Pollard family's background." Frowning, Hal leaned forward on the reception lounge sofa. "Thought you said they don't figure ever to see Frank again." "Bobby says he thinks Frank is coming apart, won't last through this last series of travels. That's just his feeling." "So then, who's their client?" "Until he fires them, Frank is." "Sounds iffy to me. Be straight with me, Clint. What's really got them so committed to this one, especially considering how crazy dangerous it seems to get hour by hour?" "They like Frank. I like Frank. I said be straight." Clint sighed. "Damned if I know. Bobby came back here spooked out of his mind, but he won't let go of it. You'd think they'd pull in their horns, at least until Frank shows up again, if he does. This brother of his, this Candy, he sounds like the devil himself, too much for anyone to handle. Bobby and Julie are stubborn sometimes, but they're not stupid, and I'd expect them to let go of this, now that they've seen it's a job big enough for God, not a private detective. But here we are. Bobby and Julie huddled with Lee Chen at the desk while he shared with them the information he had thus far obtained. "The money might be stolen, but it's spendable," Lee said. "I can't find those serial numbers on any currency hot sheets, federal, state, or local." Bobby had already thought of several sources from which Frank might have obtained the $600,000 now in the office safe. Find a business with high cash flow, where they don't always get to the bank with the receipts at the end of the day, and you've got a potential target. Say it's a supermarket, stays open till midnight, and it's not a good idea for a manager to tote a lot of cash to the bank for automatic deposit, so there's a safe in the market. After the place closes, you teleport inside, if you're Frank, and use whatever other powers you have to open that safe, put the day's receipts in a grocery bag, and vanish. You're not going to find big chunks of cash, a couple of $100,000 at a time, but you hit 3 or 4 markets in an hour, and you've got your haul. Evidently, Julie had been pondering the same question, for she said, "Casinos. They all have accounting rooms you can find on the blueprints, the ones the IRS gets into with a little effort. But they've got hidden rooms, too, where the skim goes, like big walk-in safes. Fort Knox would envy them. You use whatever minor psychic abilities you have to figure out the location of one of those hidden rooms, teleport in when it's deserted, and just take what you want." "Frank lived in Vegas for a while," Bobby said. "Remember, I told you about the vacant lot he took me to where he'd had a house?" "Well, he wouldn't be limited to Vegas," Julie said. "Reno, Tahoe, Atlantic City, the Caribbean, Macau, France, England, Monte Carlo, anywhere there's big-time gambling." This talk of easy access to unlimited amounts of cash excited Bobby, though he was not sure why. After all, it was Frank who could teleport, not him, and he was 95% sure they were never going to see Frank again. Spreading a sheaf of printouts across the desktop, Lee Chen said, "The money's the least interesting thing. You remember you wanted me to find out if the cops are onto Mr. Blue?" "Candy," Bobby said. "We have a name for him now." Lee scowled. "I liked Mr. Blue better. It had more style." Entering the room, Hal Yamataka said, "I don't think I'd trust the style judgment of a guy who wears red sneakers and socks." Lee shook his head. "We Chinese spend thousands of years working up an intimidating image for all Asians so we can keep these hapless Westerners off balance, and you Japanese blow it all by making those Godzilla movies. You can't be inscrutable and make Godzilla movies." "Yeah? You show me anybody who understands a Godzilla movie after the first one." They made an interesting pair, these two. One slender, modish, with delicate features, an enthusiastic child of the Silicon Age. The other squat, broad, with a face as blunt as a hammer, a guy who was about as high-tech as a rock. But to Bobby, the most interesting thing was that until this moment, he had never thought about the fact that a disproportionately large percentage of Dakota and Dakota's small staff was Asian-American. There were two more, Nguyen Thuan Phu and Jamie Quang, both Vietnamese. 4 out of 11 people. Though he and Hal once in a while made east-west jokes, Bobby never thought of Lee and Hal and Nguyen and Jamie as composing any subset of employees. They were just themselves, as different from one another as apples are different from pears and oranges and peaches. But Bobby realized that his predilection for Asian-American co-workers revealed something about himself, something more than just an obvious and admirable racial blindness. But he could not figure out what it was. Hal said, "And nothing gets more inscrutable than the whole concept of Mothra. By the way, Bobby, Clint's gone home to Felina. We should all be so lucky." "Lee was telling us about Mr. Blue," Julie said. "Candy," Bobby said. Indicating the data he had extracted from various police records nationwide, Lee said, "Most police agencies began to be computerized and interlinked only about 9 years ago, in any sophisticated way, that is. So that's all the further back a lot of electronically accessible files go. But during that time, there have been 78 brutal murders in 9 states that have enough similarities to raise the possibility of a single perp. Just the possibility, mind you. But FBI got interested enough last year to put a 3-man team on it, 1 in the office and 2 in the field, to coordinate local and state investigations." 3 men? Hal said. "Doesn't sound like a high priority." Well, the Bureau's always been overextended, Julie said. And over the last 30 years, since it's been unfashionable for judges to hand out long criminal sentences, the bad guys outnumber them worse than ever. 3 men full-time, that's a serious commitment at this stage. Extracting a printout from the pile on the desk, Lee summarized the essential data on it. All of the killings have these points in common. First, the victims were all bitten, most on the throat, but virtually no part of the body is sacred to this guy. Second, many of them were beaten, suffered head injuries. But loss of blood from the bites, usually the jugular vein and the carotid artery in the throat, was a substantial contributing factor to the death in virtually every instance, regardless of other injuries. On top of everything else, the guy's a vampire? Hal asked. Taking the question seriously, as indeed they had to consider every possibility in this bizarre case, regardless of how outlandish it seemed, Julie said, no, not a vampire in the supernatural sense. From what we've learned, the Pollard family is, for some reason, generously gifted. You know that magician on TV, the amazing Randy, who offers to pay $100,000 to anybody who proves they have psychic power? This Pollard clan would bankrupt his ass. But that doesn't mean there's anything supernatural about them. They're not demons or possessed or children of the devil. Nothing like that. Just some extra bit of genetic material, Bobby said. Exactly. If Candy acts like a vampire, biting people in the throat, that's just a manifestation of psychological illness, Julie said. It doesn't mean he's one of the living dead. Bobby vividly remembered the blonde giant charging him and Frank on the rain-swept black beach at Punalu. The guy was as formidable as a locomotive. If Bobby had a choice of going up against either Candy Pollard or Dracula, he might choose the undead count. Nothing as simple as a clove of garlic, a crucifix, or a well-placed wooden stake would effectively deter Frank's brother. Lee said, another similarity. In those instances where victims didn't leave doors or windows unlocked, there was no indication of how the killer gained entrance. And in many instances, police found doors deadbolted from the inside, windows locked from the inside, as if the murderer had gone up the chimney when he was done. 78, Julie said, and shivered. Lee dropped the paper onto the desk. They figure there are more, maybe a lot more, because sometimes this guy has attempted to cover his trail, the bite marks, by further mutilating or even burning the bodies. Though the cops weren't fooled in these cases, you can figure they were fooled in others. So the count's higher than 78, and that's just the last 9 years. Good job, Lee, Julie said, and Bobby seconded that. Well, I'm not done yet. Lee said. I'm going to order a pizza, do some more digging. You've been here more than 10 hours today, Bobby said. That's already above and beyond the call. Gotta have your downtime, Lee. If you believe, as I do, that time is subjective, then you've got an infinite supply. Later, at home, I'll stretch a few hours into a couple of weeks and return tomorrow quite rested. Hal Yamataka shook his head and sighed. Hate to admit it, Lee, but you're damned good at this mysterious Oriental crap. Lee smiled enigmatically. Thank you. After Bobby and Julie went home to pack an overnight bag for the trip to Santa Barbara, and after Lee returned to the computer room, Hal settled on the sofa in the boss's office, slipped off his shoes, and put his feet up on the coffee table. He still had the paperback of The Last One Left, which he'd read twice before, and which he'd started to reread last night in the hospital. If Bobby was right, when he said they might never see Frank again, Hal was in for an uneventful evening and would probably get half the book read. Maybe his happiness at Dakota and Dakota had nothing to do with the prospect of excitement, avoiding a stereotypical job as a gardener, and having the admittedly slim chance to be a hero. Maybe the thing that most affected his career decision was the realization that he simply could not mow a lawn or trim a hedge or plant 50 flats of flowers and read a book at the same time. Derek sat in his chair, pointed the ray gun at the TV, and made it be on. He said, "You don't want to watch the news?" "No," Thomas said. He was on his bed, propped up with pillows, looking at the night being dark outside the window.
"Good. Me neither."
Derek pushed buttons on the ray gun. A new picture came on the screen.
"You don't want to watch the game show?"
"No." All Thomas wanted to do was snoop on the bad thing.
"Good.
Derek pushed buttons, and the invisible rays made the screen show a new picture.
You don't want to watch the Three Stooges pretending to be funny?
No.
What do you want to watch?
Don't matter. Whatever you want to watch.
Really?
Whatever you want to watch, Thomas repeated.
Oh, gee, that's nice.
He made lots of pictures on the screen until he found a space movie where spacemen in spacesuits were poking around in some spooky place. Derek made a happy sigh and said,
This is good. I like your hats.
Helmet, Thomas said.
Space helmet. I wish I had a hat like that.
When he reached out into the big dark again, Thomas decided not to picture a mind string unraveling toward the bad thing. Instead, he pictured a ray gun shooting some invisible rays. Boy, did that work better. Wham! He was right there with the bad thing in a flash. And he felt it stronger, too, so strong he got scared and clicked off the ray gun and got all of himself back into his room with the rest of himself right away.
They got telephones in their hats, Derek said. See? They're talking through their hats.
On the TV, the spacemen were in an even spookier place poking around, which was one of the things spacemen did the most, even though something ugly nasty was usually in those spooky places just waiting for them. Spacemen never learned. Thomas looked away from the screen at the window. The dark. Bobby was scared for Julie. Bobby knew stuff Thomas didn't know. If Bobby was scared for Julie, Thomas had to be brave and do what was right. The ray gun idea worked such a lot better, it scared him. But he figured it was really good because he could easier snoop on the bad thing. He could get to the bad thing faster and get away from it faster, too. So he could snoop on it more often and not be scared about it maybe grabbing the mind string and coming back to the home with him. Grabbing an invisible ray gun ray was harder, even for a thing as fast and smart and mean as the bad thing. So he pictured pushing buttons on a ray gun again, and a part of him went through the dark, wham, to the bad thing right away. He felt how mad the bad thing was, madder than ever, and thinking lots of thoughts about blood that made Thomas half sick. Thomas wanted to come right back to the home. The bad thing felt him, you could tell. He didn't like the bad thing feeling him, knowing he was there with it, but he stayed just a couple of clock ticks longer, trying to see any thoughts about Julie in all those thoughts about blood. If the bad thing had thoughts about Julie, Thomas would TV a warning right away to Bobby. He was happy he couldn't find Julie in the bad thing's mind, and he quick ray-gunned back to the home.
Where do you think I could get a hat like that?
Derek asked. Helmet.
Even had a light on it, see?
Rising up a little from his pillows, Thomas said,
You know what kind of a story this is?
Derek shook his head.
What kind of story? It's the kind where any second some ugly nasty jumps up and sucks off the spaceman's face or maybe crawls in his mouth and down his belly and makes a nest in there.
Derek made a disgusted face.
Ew, I don't like that kind of stories.
I know, Thomas said. That's why I warned you. While Derek made a lot of different pictures come on the screen, one quick after the other, to get far away from the spaceman who was going to get his face sucked off, Thomas tried to think how long he should wait before he snooped on the bad thing again. Bobby was real worried, you could tell, even if he tried to hide it. And Bobby was not a dumb person. So it was a good idea to check on the bad thing pretty regular, in case maybe it all of a sudden thought about Julie and got up and went after her.
You want to watch this?
Derek asked. On the screen was a picture of this guy in a hockey mask with a big knife in his hand, going quiet-like across a room where a girl was asleep in a bed.
Better ray gun up another picture, Thomas said.
Because the rush hour was past, because Julie knew all the best shortcuts, but mainly because she was not in the mood to be cautious or respect the traffic laws, they made great time from the office to their home on the east end of Orange. On the way, Bobby told her about the Calcutta roach that had been part of his shoe when he and Frank had arrived on that red bridge in the garden in Kyoto. But when we popped to Mount Fuji, my shoe was okay. The roach was gone. She slowed at an intersection, but she was the only traffic in sight, so she didn't obey the four-way stop. Why didn't you tell me about this at the office? Wasn't time for every detail. Well, what do you think happened to the roach? I don't know. That's what bothers me. They were on Newport Avenue, just past Crawford Canyon. Sodium vapor street lamps cast a queer light on the roadway. Atop the steep hills to the left, several huge English Tudor and French houses, blazing like giant luxury liners, looked wildly out of place, partly because the insanely high value of such upscale real estate ensured the construction of immense houses out of proportion to the tiny lots they stood on, but partly because Tudor and French architectural styles clashed with a semi-tropical landscape. It was all a part of the California circus, some of which he hated, most of which he loved. Those houses never bothered him before, and given the serious problems he and Julie faced, he couldn't figure out why they bothered him now. Maybe he was so jumpy that even these minor disharmonies reminded him of the chaos that had almost engulfed him during his travels with Frank. He said, "Do you have to drive so fast?" "Yes," she said curtly. "I want to get home, get packed, get to Santa Barbara, learn what we can about the Pollard family, get finished with this whole damn creepy case." "Well, if you feel that way, why don't we just drop it here? Frank comes back. We give him his money, his jar of red diamonds, tell him we're sorry. We think he's a prince of a guy, but we're out of it." "We can't," she said. He chewed on his lower lip and said, "I know, but I can't figure out why we're compelled to hang in there with this one." They crested the hill and speeded north, past the entrance to Rocking Horse Ridge. Their own development was only a couple of streets ahead on the left. As she finally began to brake for the turn, she glanced at him and said, "You really don't know why we can't bug out of it?" "No." "You're saying you do?" "I know." "Tell me." "You'll figure it out eventually." "Don't be mysterious. That's not like you." She swung the company Toyota into their development, then onto their street. "I'll tell you what I think. It'll upset you. You'll deny it. We'll argue. And I don't want to argue with you." "Why will we argue?" She pulled into their driveway, put the car in park, switched off the lights and engine, and turned to him. Her eyes shone in the dark. "When you understand why we can't let go, you won't like what it says about us. And you'll argue that I'm wrong, that we're just a couple of sweet kids, really. You like to see us as a couple of sweet kids, savvy, but basically innocent at the same time, like a young Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. I really love you for that, for being such a dreamer about the world and us. And it'll hurt me when you want to argue." He almost started to argue with her about whether he would argue with her. Then he stared at her for a moment and finally said, "I've had this feeling that I'm not facing up to something, that when this is all over and I realize why I was so determined to see this through to an end, my motivations won't be as noble as I think they are now. It's a damn weird feeling, as if I don't really know myself. Maybe we spend all our lives learning to know ourselves. And maybe we never really do, completely." She kissed him lightly, quickly, and got out of the car. As he followed her up the sidewalk to the front door, he glanced at the sky. The clarity of the day had been short-lived. A pall of clouds concealed the moon and stars. The sky was very dark. And he was gripped by the curious certainty that a great and terrible weight was falling toward them, black against the black heavens, and therefore invisible, but falling fast. Faster.
Candy kept a chokehold on his fury, which strained like an attack dog trying to break its leash. He rocked and rocked, and gradually the shy visitor grew bolder. Repeatedly he felt the invisible hand on his head. Initially it lay upon him as lightly as an empty silk glove, and it stayed only briefly before flitting away. But as he pretended to be disinterested in both the hand and the person to whom it belonged, the visitor grew more daring, the hand heavier and less nervous. Though Candy made no effort to probe at the mind of the intruder for fear of scaring him away, some of the stranger's thoughts came to him nonetheless. He did not think the visitor was aware that images and words from his own mind were slipping into Candy's. They were just leaking out of him, as if they were trickles of water seeping from pin-sized holes in a rusty bucket. The name Julie came several times, and once an image floated along with the name, an attractive woman with brown hair and dark eyes. Candy wasn't sure if it was the visitor's face or the face of someone the visitor knew, or even if it was the face of anyone who really existed. There were aspects that made it seem unreal. A pale light radiated from it, and the features were so kind and serene that it looked like the holy countenance of a saint in an illustrated Bible. The word Flutterby leaked out of the visitor's mind more than once, sometimes with other words like, "Remember the Flutterby," or "Don't be a Flutterby," and each time that word flitted through his mind, the visitor quickly withdrew. But he kept coming back, because Candy did nothing to make him feel unwelcome. Candy rocked and rocked. The chair made a soft sound. Creak, 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 creak. He waited. He kept an open mind. Creak, creak, creak. Twice the name Bobby seeped from the visitor's mind. And the second time, a fuzzy image of a face was linked to it, another very kind face. It was idealized, like Julie's face. Recognition stirred in Candy, but Bobby's visage was not as clear or detailed as Julie's, and Candy did not want to concentrate on it because the visitor might notice his interest and be frightened off. During his long and patient courtship of the shy intruder, many other words and images came to Candy, but he didn't know what to make of them. Men in spacesuits. Bad thing. A guy in a hockey mask. The home. Dumb people. A bathrobe, a half-eaten Hershey's bar, and a sudden frantic thought. Draw bugs, no good. Draw bugs, got to be neat. More than 10 minutes passed without contact, and Candy started to worry that the intruder had gone away for good. But suddenly, he was back. This time the contact was strong, more intimate than ever. When Candy sensed that the visitor was more confident, he knew the time had come to act. He pictured his mind as a steel trap, the visitor as an inquisitive mouse, and he pictured the trap springing, the bar pinning the visitor to the kill plate. Shocked, the visitor tried to pull away. Candy held him and pushed across the telepathic bridge between them, trying to storm his adversary's mind to find out who he was, where he was, and what he wanted. Candy had no telepathic power of his own, nothing to equal even the weak telepathic gifts of the intruder. He had never read anyone's mind before, and he did not know how to go about it. As it turned out, he did not need to do anything except open himself and receive what the visitor gave him. Thomas was his name, and he was terrified of Candy, of having done something really dumb, and of putting Julie in danger. That trinity of terrors shattered his mental defenses and caused him to disgorge a flood of information. In fact, there was too much information for Candy to make sense of it, a babble of words and images. He tried desperately to sort through it for clues to Thomas's identity and location. Dumb people. Cielo Vista, the home. Everybody here has bad IQs. Care home, good food. TV, the best place for us, Cielo Vista. The aides are nice. We watch the hummingbirds. The world is bad out there, too bad for us out there. Cielo Vista, care home. With some astonishment, Candy realized that the visitor was someone with a subnormal intellect. He even picked up the term Down's syndrome, and he was afraid that he was not going to be able to sort enough meaningful thoughts from the babble to get a fix on Thomas's location. Depending on the size of his IQ, Thomas might not know where Cielo Vista Care Home was, even though he apparently lived there. Then a series of images spun out of Thomas's mind, a well-linked chain of serial memories that still caused him some emotional pain, the trip to Cielo Vista in a car with Julie and Bobby on the day they first checked him into the place. This was different from most of Thomas's other thoughts and memories, in that it was richly detailed, and so clearly retained that it unreeled like a length of motion picture film, giving Candy all he needed to know. He saw the highways over which they had driven that day, saw the route markers flashing past the car window, saw every landmark at every turn, all of which Thomas had struggled mightily to memorize, because all through the trip he kept thinking, if I don't like it there, if people are mean there, if it's too scary there, if it's too much being alone there, I got to know how I can find the way back to Bobby and Julie any time I want. Remember this. Remember all of this. Turn there at the 7-Eleven, right there at the 7-Eleven. Don't forget that 7-Eleven. And I'll go past those three palm trees. What if they don't come visit me? No. That's a bad thing to think. They love me. They'll come. But what if they don't? Look there. Remember that house. You go past that house. Remember that house with the blue roof. Kendi got it all. As precise a fix as he could have obtained from a geographer who would have spoken precisely in degrees and minutes of longitude and latitude. It was more than he needed to know to make use of his gift. He opened the trap and let Thomas go. He got up from the rocker. He pictured Cielo Vista care home as it appeared so exquisitely detailed in Thomas's memory. He pictured Thomas's room on the first floor of the north wing at the northwest corner. Darkness. Billions of hot sparks spinning in the void. Velocity.
Because Julie was in a let's-move-and-get-it-done mood, they had stopped at the house only 15 minutes, long enough to throw toiletries and a change of clothes in an overnight bag. At McDonald's on Chapman Avenue in Orange, she swung by the drive-through window and got dinner to eat on the way, Big Macs, fries, Diet Colas. Before they reached the Costa Mesa freeway, while Bobby was still divvying up the extra packets of mustard and opening the containers that held the Big Macs, Julie had clipped the radar detector to the rearview mirror, plugged it in the Toyota cigarette lighter, and switched it on. Bobby had never before eaten fast food at high speed, but he figured they averaged 85 miles an hour north on the Costa Mesa to the Riverside Freeway, west to the Orange Freeway, north, and he was still finishing his French fries when they were only a couple of exits away from the Foothill Freeway east of Los Angeles. Though the rush hour was well past and the traffic unusually light, maintaining that pace required a lot of lane changing and nerve. He said, "We keep this up, I'll never have a chance to die from the cholesterol in this Big Mac." Lee says cholesterol doesn't kill us. Is that what he says? He says we live forever, and all cholesterol can do is move us out of this life a little sooner. Same thing must be true if I slip up and roll this sucker a few times. I don't think that will happen, he said. You're the best driver I've ever seen. Thank you, Bobby. You're the best passenger. The only thing I wonder, yeah? If we don't really die, just move on, and I don't have to worry about anything, why the hell did I bother to get Diet Colas? Thomas rolled off the bed onto his feet.
Derek, go. Get out. He's coming.
Derek was watching a horse talking on TV and didn't hear Thomas. The TV was in the room's middle, between the beds, and by the time Thomas got there and grabbed Derek to make him listen, a funny sound was all around them. Not funny ha-ha, but funny weird, like somebody whistling but not whistling. There was a wind, too, a couple of puffs. Not warm or cold either, but it made Thomas shiver when it blew on him. Pulling Derek off his chair, Thomas said,
"Bad things coming. You get out. You go. Like I said before. No."
Derek just made a dumb face at him, then smiled like he figured Thomas was pretending to be funny the way the Three Stooges pretended. He'd forgot all about the promise he made Thomas. He thought the bad thing was going to be poached eggs for breakfast, and when poached eggs never showed up on his plate, he figured he was safe. But now he wasn't safe and didn't know it. More funny, weird whistling. More wind. Giving Derek a shove, making him get started for the door, Thomas shouted, "Run!" The whistling stopped. The wind stopped. And all of a sudden, from nowhere, the bad thing was there, between them and the open door. It was a man, like Thomas already knew it was, But it was more than just a man. It was darkness poured in the shape of a man, like a piece of the night itself had come in through the window, and not just because it wore a black T-shirt and black pants, but because it was all deep dark inside. You could tell. Right away, Derek was afraid. Nobody needed to tell him this was a bad thing, not now when he could see it with his own eyes. But he didn't see it was too late to run, and he went straight at the bad thing, like maybe he could push past it, which must have been what he was figuring, because even Derek wasn't dumb enough to figure he could knock it down. It was so big. The bad thing grabbed him and lifted him before he had any chance to get around it. Lifted him right up off the floor, like he didn't weigh any more than a pillow. Derek screamed, and the bad thing slammed him against the wall so hard his scream stopped. And pictures of Derek's mom and dad and brother fell off the wall. Not the one where Derek got slammed, but another wall all the way around the room from him and over his bed. The bad thing was so fast. That was the worst thing about it, how awful fast it was. It slammed Derek against the wall. Derek's mouth fell open, but no sound came from him. The bad thing slammed him again, right away harder, though the first time was hard enough for anybody, and Derek's eyes went funny. The bad thing took him away from the wall and slammed him down on the work table. The table kind of shivered like it would fall apart, but it didn't. Derek's head was over the table edge hanging down, so Thomas was looking at his face upside down, eyes blinking fast, upside down, mouth open real wide, but no sound coming out. He looked up from Derek's face, looked right across Derek's body at the bad thing, which was looking at him and grinning, like all this was a joke, funny ha-ha, which it wasn't. No way. Then it picked up the scissors on the edge of the work table, the ones Thomas used to make his picture poems, the one that almost fell on the floor when it slammed Derek on the table. It made the scissors go into Derek and bring the blood out of him, into poor Derek, who wouldn't hurt no one himself except himself, who wouldn't know how to hurt anyone. And the bad thing made the scissors go in again, and bring more blood out of another place in Derek, and in again, and again. Then blood wasn't coming out just four places on Derek's chest and belly, where the scissors had been made to go in, but out of his mouth and nose, too. The bad thing lifted Derek off the table, the scissors still sticking out of his front, and threw him like he was just a pillow. No, like he was a garbage bag. Threw him the way the Santa Nation men threw the garbage bags onto their Santa Nation trucks. Derek landed on his bed, on his back, on his bed, with the scissors still in him, and didn't move, and was gone to the bad place. You could tell. And the worst thing was, it all happened so fast, faster than Thomas could think what to do to stop it. Footsteps in the hall, people running. Thomas yelled for help. Pete, one of the aides, showed up in the doorway. Pete saw Derek on the bed, scissors in him, blood coming out everywhere, and he got afraid. You could see him get it. He turned to the bad thing and said, "Who?" But the bad thing grabbed him by the neck, and Pete made a sound like something was stuck in his throat. He put both his hands on the bad thing's arm, which seemed bigger than Pete's two arms together, but he couldn't make the bad thing let go. The bad thing lifted him by his neck, making his chin turn up and his head bend back, and then it took hold of him by the belt, too, and pitched him back out the door, into the hall. Pete hit a nurse who came running up just then, and they both went down on the floor, out there in the hall, all tangled up and screaming. All of this in a few clock ticks. So fast. The bad thing made the door shut with a bang, saw you couldn't lock it. Then did the funniest thing of all. Funny weird, funny scary. He held both his hands out at the door, and this blue light came from his hands, the way not blue came from a flashlight. Sparks flew from hinges and around the knob and all around the door edges. Everything metal smoked and turned all soft, like butter when you put it on mashed potatoes. It was a fire door. They said you had to keep your door closed if you ever saw fire in the hall. Not try to run in the hall, but keep your door closed and stay put. They called it a fire door because fire couldn't get through it, they said, and Thomas always wondered why they didn't call it a fire-can't-get-through-it door, but he never asked. The thing was, a fire door was all metal so it couldn't burn, but now it melted around the edges, and so did the metal frame. They melted together. It didn't look like you could ever get through that door again. People started pounding on the door from out there in the hall, tried to make it open, couldn't, and shouted for Thomas and Derek. Thomas knew some voices and who they belonged to. He wanted to yell for them to help quick because he was in trouble. But he couldn't make a sound any better than poor Derek. The bad thing made the blue light stop. It turned and looked at Thomas. It smiled at him. It didn't have a nice smile. It said, "Thomas." Thomas was surprised he could stand up. He was so scared. He was against the wall by the window, and he thought of maybe making the lock open on the window and push it up and get out, which he knew how to do because of emergency drills, but he knew he wasn't fast enough. No way, because the bad thing was the fastest he ever saw. It took a step toward him and another step. "Are you Thomas?" For a while, he still couldn't find the way to make sounds. He could just move his mouth and sort of pretend to make sounds. Then, while he was doing that, he figured maybe if he told a lie and said he wasn't Thomas, the bad thing would believe him and just go away. So, when all of a sudden he could make sounds and then words, he said,
No, not Thomas. He's gone out in the world now. He's got a big IQ. He's a high-end moron. Oh, they moved him out of the world.
The bad thing laughed. It was a laugh that had no funny in it, the worst Thomas had ever heard. The bad thing said, "Who the hell are you, Thomas? Where do you come from? How come a dummy like you can do something I can't?" Thomas didn't answer. He didn't know what to say. He wished the people in the hall would stop pounding on the door and find some other way to get in, because pounding wasn't working. Maybe they could call the cops and tell them to bring the jaws of life. Yeah, the jaws of life, like you saw the news on TV news when a person was in a wrecked car and couldn't get out. They could use the jaws of life to pull open the door, the way they pulled up smashed cars to get people out of them. He hoped the cops wouldn't say, "We're sorry, but we can only open car doors with the jaws of life. We can't open care home doors," because then he was finished for sure. "You gonna answer me, Thomas?" the bad thing asked. Derek's TV chair got turned around in the fight, and now it was between Thomas and the bad thing. The bad thing held one hand out at the chair, just one, and the blue light went whoosh, and the chair blew up in splinters, like all the toothpicks in the world. Thomas threw his hands over his face just fast enough so no splinters went in his eyes. Some went in the backs of his hands, and even in his cheeks and chin, and he could feel some of them in his shirt poking his belly. But he didn't feel any hurt, because he was so busy feeling scared. He took his hands from his eyes right away, because he had to see where the bad thing was. Where it was right on top of him, with soft bits of the chair's insides floating in the air in front of his face. "Thomas," it said, and it put one of its hands on the front of Thomas's neck, the way it did Pete a while ago. Thomas heard words coming from himself, and he couldn't believe he was making them, but he was. Then, when he heard what he had said to the bad thing, he couldn't believe he said it, but he did.
"You're not being sociable."
The bad thing grabbed him by the belt and kept hold of him by the neck and lifted him off the floor and pulled him away from the wall, then slammed him into the wall, the same way it did Derek. And oh, it hurt worse than Thomas ever before hurt in his life.
The interior garage door had a deadbolt but no security chain. Pocketing his keys, Clint entered the kitchen at 8:10 and saw Felina sitting at the table reading a magazine while she waited for him. She looked up and smiled, and his heart thumped faster at the sight of her, just like in every sappy love story ever written. He wondered how this could have happened to him. He had been so self-contained before Felina. He had been proud of the fact that he needed no one for intellectual stimulation or emotional support, and that he was therefore not vulnerable to the pains and disappointments of human relationships. Then he had met her. When he caught his breath, he had been as vulnerable as anyone, and glad of it. She looked terrific in a simple blue dress with a red belt and matching red shoes.
She was so strong, yet so gentle, so tough, yet so fragile. He went to her, and for a while they stood by the refrigerator next to the sink, holding each other and kissing, neither of them speaking in either of the ways they could. Clint thought they would have been happy just then, even if both of them had been deaf and mute, capable of neither lip-reading nor sign language, because at that moment what made them happy was the very fact of being together, which no words could adequately express anyway. Finally, he said, "What a day! Can't wait to tell you all about it. Let me clean up real quick, change clothes, and we'll be out of here by 8:30. Go over to Caprabello's, get a corner booth, some wine, some pasta, some garlic bread." "Some heartburn?" He laughed, because it was true. They both love Caprabello's, but the food was spicy. They always suffered for the indulgence. He kissed her again, and she sat down with her magazine, and he went through the dining room and down the hall to the bathroom. While he let the water run in the sink to get it hot, he plugged in his electric razor and began to shave, grinning at himself in the mirror, because he was such a damn lucky guy.
The bad thing was right in his face, snarling at him, lots of questions, too many for Thomas to think about and answer, even if he was sitting in a chair, quiet and happy, instead of lifted off the floor and held against the wall with his whole back hurting so bad he had to cry. He kept saying, "I'm full up! I'm full up!" Always when he said that, people stopped asking him things or telling him things. They let him take time to make his head clear. But the bad thing was not like other people. It didn't care if his head was clear. It just wanted answers. Who was Thomas? Who was his mother? Who was his father? Where did he come from? Who was Julie? Who was Bobby? Where was Julie? Where was Bobby? Then the bad thing said, "Hell, you're just a dummy. You don't know the answers, do you? You're just as stupid as you are stupid-looking." It pulled Thomas away from the wall, held him off the floor with one hand on his neck, so Thomas couldn't breathe good. It slapped Thomas in the face, hard, and Thomas didn't want to keep crying, but he couldn't stop. He hurt and was scared. "Why do they let people like you live?" the bad thing asked. It let go of Thomas, and Thomas dropped to the floor. The bad thing looked down at him in a mean way that made Thomas angry almost as much as it made him scared, which was funny weird, because he almost never got angry. And this was the first time he was ever angry and scared both at the same time. But the bad thing was looking at him like he was just a bug or some dirt on the floor that had to be made clean. "Why don't they kill you people at birth? What are you good for? Why don't they kill you at birth and chop you up and make dog food out of you?" Thomas had memories of how people out there in the world looked at him that way or said mean things, and how Julie always told them off. She said Thomas didn't have to be nice to people like that, said he could tell them they were being rude. Now Thomas was angry, like he had every right to be. And even if Julie never told him he could be angry about these things, he probably would be angry anyway, because some things you just knew were right or wrong. The bad thing kicked him in the leg and was going to kick him again, you could tell, but a noise was made at the window. Some of the aides were at the window. They broke a little square of glass and reached through, wanting to find the lock. When the glass made a breaking sound, the bad thing turned from Thomas and held its hands up at the window, like it was asking the aides to stop wanting in. But Thomas knew what it was going to do was make the blue light. Thomas wanted to warn the aides, but he figured nobody would hear him or listen to him until it was too late. So while the bad thing's back was turned, he crawled across the floor, away from the bad thing, even if crawling hurt, even if he had to go through spots of Derek's blood, all wet, and it made him sick on top of being angry and scared. Blue light. Very bright. Something exploded. He heard glass falling, and worse, like maybe not just the whole window blew out on the aides, but part of the wall, too. People screamed. Most of the screams cut off quick-like, but one of them went on. It was real bad, like somebody out in the dark, past the blown-up window, was made to hurt even worse than Thomas. Thomas didn't look back, because he was all the way around the side of Derek's bed now, where he couldn't see the window anyway, from where he was on the floor. And besides, he knew what he wanted now, where he wanted to go, and he had to get there before the bad thing got interested in him again. Quick-like, he crawled to the top of the